Welcome, folks, to the Andy Social Podcast. My name is Andy Dowling, and I'm sure you guys know already, but I'm going to run through this really quickly. I also play bass in the Australian metal band Lord, and if you love a bit of 80s metal, go on over to lord.net.au and you can give our music a crack over there. We're also on Spotify if you search for Lord. I understand that if you type in Lord, more than likely you're going to struggle to find us. So the best thing to do is type in Lord Prog Power USA, which is our latest release, our live album that was recorded in 2016. In Atlanta, Georgia, United States of America. And we're really proud of that release, and you can go and listen to that there. You can also watch the release via Vimeo by going to lord.net.au and following the links through there as well. You can also check out all of our back catalogue, which is on all those platforms also. Blah, 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 blah. Moving along, I also host the Self-Starter Podcast, which is all about small business, self-employment, and freelancing. So if that tickles your pickle, you can go over to selfstarter.com.au, check out the fortnightly podcast episodes, you can check out the blog, which I'm really, really trying to stay disciplined and continue to write them. I understand that they're a little bit rough around the edges, but you know, the intention's there, and I'm doing my best, guys. I'm doing my best. But selfstarter.com.au, go on over there, go and check it out. And I'd love to hear some feedback from you guys. I was also, while I remember, I'm going to keep plugging this. I was a finalist for Host of the Year for the 2018 Australian Podcast Awards for the Self-Starter Podcast. So if you want a taste of where that's all going, and the vibe around Self-Starter, the vibe, I can't believe I just said that, go to selfstarter.com.au and go and check all that out. Now, moving along, this week's shout out. So for people that are new to the podcast, each and every week, I thank somebody that does something amazing for me, for the podcast, whether it be Andy Social or Self-Starter. It could be for Lord, whatever. And it could be a range of different things. It could be leaving reviews on Facebook or Apple Podcast, Stitcher, somewhere in the deep dark internets, whatever it might be. It could be buying a t-shirt. It could be shouting me a beer via paypal.me on the andysocial.net website. It could be a message of encouragement. It could be liking, retweeting, tagging mates, recommending the podcast to somebody, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's all beneficial for me. It means a hell of a lot to me, and it helps everything that I do get bigger and better. So I thank you all for all the support that you guys do, especially just listening to me crap on now. But there can only be one each week. And so this week's shout out, this week's thank you is for Tim Bainbridge. Now, Tim has been a massive supporter in recent weeks and recent months with the podcast. He's pretty much ticked every single box of what you could do to support me as far as the Andy Social Podcast is concerned. He's shouted me a beer via paypal.me. He's left a review, and he is constantly like just messaging me and giving me encouragement, and definitely trading some stories with a lot of the stuff that he's doing as well. And Tim plays in a band. He's got his own project called Star Eternal. So you can go and search for Star Eternal on Facebook. You can go to StarEternal.net. And you can also pre-order his new album, which is called, oh, I'm going to butcher this, Archetypica, I believe. And it's out on the 2nd of June 2018. So you can go and order that over at StarEternal.net. So a massive thank you, Tim. Really, really appreciate the support. It means a hell of a lot to me. And please shoot me a message when you hear this, and give me a little bit of a nudge, and I'll send you out something ridiculous in the mail. Yeah, I've got something. We all like getting something in the post, so I'll find something for you. But thank you so much, Tim. I really, really appreciate the support, as with the rest of you guys, and keep the support going. It means a lot, and I'll do my best to continue to do shout-outs for everyone over the coming weeks and months and years, and just, well, however long this podcast continues on. Anyway, moving along, this week's guest. Finally, I've been trying to get this guy for so long. I've bailed on him. He's bailed on me. Our paths just don't seem to cross quite often, but I've got him. It's Higo. It's Dave Higgins. Now, if you're in Australia, you'll probably know who Higo is. Now, Higo was probably best known at one point as being one of the hosts on Triple M. He hosted the Distortion show, which is a hard rock, heavy metal show that was on Triple M, and got a lot of support for a lot of Australian bands. And a lot of Australian bands really got introduced to him around that stage because he was just doing so much for the hard rock and the metal community. And many people continue to stay in contact with him over the years. And Higo puts on a lot of shows these days. He's a part of these great events. And he's just a massive, massive supporter for Australian music in general. So I'm going to let Higo explain. I'm so sorry in advance. I actually did the This Is Your Life thing. Oh, tell me about when you first got into radio. And we just went from there. And it's good. It's really interesting because I learned a hell of a lot about Higo, and really, really fascinating guy, and he's got some really, really important stories and messages for you guys to tune into. So everything that we discuss, as always, is in the show notes over at andysocial.net, so please go over there and check it out. But if you want to find Higo, you can search for Higo on Twitter by you can just type in twitter.com/Higo74, or you can go to Facebook and you can type in Dave Higgins or Dave Higo Higgins. Facebook.com/Dave Higo Higgins is the complete URL to go there. And we're going to have a bunch of other stuff over in the show notes over at andysocial.net. So make sure you go over there and check it out. Enough of me. I am talking so quickly. I need to slow down. And here is this episode with old mate, great mate, Higo, Dave Higo Higgins. Bye-bye.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you, sir?
Yeah, good. Yourself?
Yeah, not too bad.
I read on your Twitter, you posted a couple of hours ago about having to put some pants on.
Yeah, a bit chilly today.
Oh, mate, I'm wearing shorts, and I second-guessed my decision when I saw that. It only took you to give me a reality check. I was shivering without actually knowing why I was, but yeah, I think I probably should have got some long pants.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you you got to come to the harsh reality that winter is finally coming.
And you're not as tough as you think you are.
No, I'm old and, you know, I'm not tough.
Well, I thought I'd get this this conversation cracking with giving you the soapbox, because I saw something else that you posted this morning and I thought I think I need to give you the opportunity to vent. You wrote an article last night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's disappeared somewhere?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the full story is that because I write stuff for a website called I Love Your Old Stuff, right?
Yep.
And I was writing an article about Black Sabbath and the singles they released in the 70s after a self-imposed singles ban, so, which is great because, you know, it's just an excuse to go back and get sidetracked and listen to a shitload of Sabbath. But I, after writing this article, I was watching some TV and I closed the top of my laptop and thought I'll get back to that, and didn't realize that it wasn't plugged in. So it went flat. And then this morning I had to wake up and record a couple of radio shows. And when I closed off a document relating to that, it said, would you like to recover these documents? And me thinking it was an old radio document, just said, no, thanks, and closed it off. So the autosave was doing its job. But I wasn't. So I'm in the process of rewriting the whole bloody thing, which is good and bad because, you know, you can go to kind of go, oh, I remember what I was writing here, and you'll change a couple of things to, you know, self-edit. But I am just so distracted. I'm listening to more and more Sabbath and not at all what I'm supposed to be doing. Not the songs that I'm writing about, I'm not listening to them. I'm listening to everything else.
And I'm assuming that it wasn't just a couple of paragraphs, a short little piece that you were writing. It was something of considerable length.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
A couple of pages, you know.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well,
but that's just the way it goes. It's a lesson learned. Always back up your work.
Well, that's it. And as one very well-educated person told me many years ago, that's rock and roll. And that was basically the nice way of saying shit happens, mate. So, you know, roll with it.
All right, I'll put it down to rock and roll then.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, how fitting. I don't know which way to go with this. I've got so many things to pick your brain about, but I thought I'd go back a little bit and ask probably a question that you've been asked a million times, but how the hell did you get into radio, and was there even an interest to do it, or did you just sort of stumble into it and someone opened the door for you? Or what was the sort of the turning point, or was there even a light bulb moment?
I think it really now looking back, it definitely started in high school. And, you know, I was given a clock radio when I was very young, and it was an old style clock radio where the numbers would flip over. It wasn't digital. It was very old. And that was the only thing I had to listen to music on. And, I would put this radio on, and it was stuck on Fox FM here in Melbourne. The dial, you couldn't change it. As much as I tried, because my best friend down the street, he was a Triple M, you know, he's like, what are you listening to that pop music for? You know, you got to listen to the rock music. And I'm talking like 1984 or something like that. And I just said, oh, well, I'm stuck with this. But every Sunday night was Casey Kasem's American Top 40.
Right.
And so I would listen to that as I went to sleep. And I thought, what a cool job. Listening to this guy interviewing all the artists, playing all the latest songs, that's a cool job. But, you know, you just think that as a 10-year-old and you don't really give it too much credence. But later on in life, in high school, when I was in year 11 and 12, I really got into the media side of things. And every lunchtime we would have two or three of us in our media department running a radio station, kind of. It was just us playing CDs and talking, and the music was going out to the cafeteria area. And again, once I left school, you don't really give that much thought. You think, oh, I've got no idea how to get into that, so I'll just go off into the normal world of working and, you know, doing shit jobs that you don't really enjoy. And, you know, found myself as an apprentice printer, and then I did a bit of engineering, and then, oh, Jesus, you name it. I worked in a bird seed factory. And then worked in a warehouse for Safeway, which is now Woolworths, at night. And I did that for about 3.5 years. And they were changing to go all sort of automated. And I thought, well, what can I do? Do I hang around here or do I take this voluntary redundancy that they're offering? And the money was okay. So I thought, well, I don't really want to do this. I don't like working at night. I'm tired of driving forklifts. So how about I take the money and run and figure out what I want to actually do? I took about a year and a half off and did a bit of traveling. And then, when I got back, I went, all right, I don't need a job here, and sort of fell back into going back to forklift driving because it was what I knew how to do and I was licensed. And, but then every weekend I was looking at the paper and the broadsheet here and just sort of going, oh, there's got to be something else. And I saw an ad for Melbourne Radio School. And I thought, I wonder if I could give that a go. A 10-week course, you're 3 hours a week on a Wednesday night. I can still work and do this. And so I did that. And at the end of this course, I said to the guy who was running it, who was a very well-established and esteemed member of the radio fraternity, I just asked him one simple question. I said, do you think I've got what it takes to do this? And he said, yes. And that's when I just tipped
good enough
all the chips in and went hell for leather, made a demo, sent it out to 42 stations. I think that's what the count got up to before I actually got a job.
Yep.
Blind applications they were, and everywhere from Charleville in Queensland to Tasmania to WA. I mean, I was just looking for an in somewhere. And it finally came in by July 1999. I was gainfully employed as a copywriter at 2LT and Kiss FM in Lithgow, New South Wales.
Oh, where dreams come true.
Yeah, but I mean, as soon as I was there, you know, you get the lay of the land and you soon discover what radio is all about. And it was probably a really good place to start because it was a privately owned station. It wasn't part of a network or anything. And it was a real learning curve where you just sort of go in and you can try your hand at everything. I mean, I was primarily a copywriter, but I got to do on-air work there and read ads and write other things and promos. And the only thing I didn't do was sales because fuck that. And but from the moment I got in there and kind of got my feet on the ground and went, okay, how do I get out of here? And that was kind of my next – that was what I took with me to every station. I just saw every small station as a stepping stone to get back to Fox and get on air there.
And it's like just a foot in the door, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I tell you what, like, I mean, going back, I'll take a couple of steps back because there's a few things that my ears pricked up, especially the birdseed factory. it sounds like a comedy skit just waiting to happen. But I mean, going back to doing a bit of sort of informal muck around sort of high school radio sort of stuff. I mean, I remember when I was in high school and I never took any interest in it, which now in hindsight was a big missed opportunity, but probably was for my benefit that I wasn't involved. But did they have any sort of stricter sort of, you know, requests for you guys using it to make sure it remained G-rated and certain things that you could and couldn't do? I mean, was it pretty just loose and it was just no one was using it, so why not get on there and see what you can make of it?
Well, obviously, we had to be very careful. And, yeah, you had to keep it G-rated because there's kids around. it was nothing sort of outlandish. We weren't doing skits or anything like that. We were basically just talking about the music and then playing the songs. And we made sure not to talk too long because people really didn't want to hear us. They just wanted to hear the music. It was just us playing our favorites.
Yeah.
There was no format as such. So it wasn't just going to be rock. It wasn't just going to be this or that. It was predominantly rock music, but it was everything from classic rock from the 70s to, you know, the indie stuff that we were listening to at the time, you know, Dinosaur Jr. to Suicidal Tendencies to Queen and Steppenwolf and whatever, you know. It was a hodgepodge of stuff, but it was a lot of fun.
Did you get a lot of feedback when you guys were doing that, just from other peers, or was it more of a case that it was just amusing you guys only?
Just amusing us. We got no feedback from anyone. We looked at it though, is if there was no news, then that was good news, because if the teachers didn't come and go, oh, you can't say that, you can't play this, then, you know, we pretty much had free reign. We were in a good school, and it was a, and I mean good school as far as the teachers go, and they're understanding, and they were encouraging of people exploring that. You know, that's a possible endeavor, I guess, especially the media and music side of things and the theater side. They were really encouraging of everyone to try stuff and just see if it fits or if you're good at it. And because some people sort of gravitated towards production side of things rather than being in front of the camera, they were behind it. Whereas I was always kind of in front of it or, you know, on the mic or whatever, trying to just making people laugh and fuck around. So I was more of an entertainer side than I don't want to organize anything. Well, I just want to mess around.
From the outside looking in, and I mean, I've listened to you for quite a few years in varying platforms, different little nooks and crannies. But, you know, I mean, when I hear you talk, I go, that's a guy with a radio voice. And, you know, that's obviously years of you doing the job. But even back then, did you feel that you had something that sort of cut through a little bit more than maybe some of your mates or other people, something that you felt you had a bit of a gift there? I mean, you can talk yourself up a little bit here. Don't be humble. But I hear you talk and I go, that's a radio voice. Like if I'm hearing, what people would envision radio to sound like, I don't know, that's what comes out of your mouth.
No, I never really thought about it that way. I think it's something that you develop over time when you learn to be expressive on the air if you listen to some of my early demos and stuff, it's cringeworthy, and everyone's the same because you're trying so hard to be radio. And then it's not until you relax and try and make it conversational, then that's when you kind of find your voice, I guess. And that's the beauty of when, you know, the old days when you used to have to go to places like Lithgow and then I went to Horsham and then Mandurah and WA, and you get to find your voice and you settle into this groove and you figure out that, hey, this works. I like where this is headed now. So I don't know. It's one of those things. It's funny you should say that, because I listened to some of the people that I looked up to when I was younger and they're friends now. And when I hear them talk, I go, God, you've got such a radio voice, but that's the way that people are. It's weird.
And maybe it's
a weird one.
And maybe it's a familiarity with just hearing somebody in that platform or on that platform and just becoming, you know, so used to it that it's just an association thing that you've built up over time. So it's not so much just the voice. It's just you being associated with that's caused that.
Perhaps.
Maybe. But I don't know. I hear that whenever you talk, even when you're talking now, it sounds like I'm on your radio show. So, yeah.
Go ahead, Corey. You're on the air.
Yeah. Perfect. You mentioned before about demos and shooting out like 40-plus-odd demos and just trying to do the blanket approach and hoping you get a bite. It sounds a lot like, you know, the old school sort of send your tape out as a band trying to get signed by a label. Was it a similar sort of thing? I spoke to Wilco last year, and I know Neil, and he spoke about going through this process of, you know, getting a demo reel together and all that. And it sounds very similar to what a band would have done back in the day and what bands still do now. Only we shoot MP3s across the world, but you know, was it a similar sort of process?
Yeah, absolutely. It was, make a demo, edit it down, then make a billion copies of it and package it up and send it off. And it was one of those things where I had seen what had come into radio stations, via the teacher at the radio school, and how people would just send it in like in a post pack with a cover letter, the resume, and a couple other bits and pieces of the tape. And I thought, well, that doesn't really stand out. So I thought, how do I get mine to stand out? There's going to be program directors all around the country who receive tapes like mine. So what do you do to make them actually open yours? So I resorted to getting I went down to a box factory and bought a shitload of VHS cassette boxes. Like, I had to fold them up myself, but they were really cheap. And then my brother, he runs a signwriting business, and so he's got a whole bunch of different coloured vinyl, and I used to go down there and grab the scraps off it and make each side of the box a different colour. And then I would, put the tag on the front with a big bloody – it was a big giant star-shaped tag with my name and details and blah, blah, blah. So, and you can imagine, if you're going through post pack after boring post pack and all of a sudden you get this multicoloured bright box, you want to know what's in it. And so it would open up, and I would tape the cover letter and everything to the lid. So as you open it up, it's sort of – it's like this presentation box, and there's my demo sitting in the bottom. So – I got a lot of replies. I mean, and the hardest thing is when you send all these things out and you just don't get any reply at all. And it is so disheartening. Some people would write back saying, the traditional form letter. Thanks so much. We've got you on file. And then other people would actually write back, when letters were still handwritten, that they really appreciated the effort and they can hear the potential, but they don't have anything, but stay in touch. And they're the people that I sort of gravitated to. But yeah, it's definitely like bands. You're just hoping for pot luck. You just got to put yourself out there and hopefully someone will listen and then give you some constructive criticism, as to how you can maybe progress to that next level. It really is a crapshoot back in the day. Like you said, now it's just all about MP3s and, people sending video, resumes and all kinds of stuff. But yeah, back then when I was starting, it was all on tape. It was all handwritten. You know, it was pretty basic stuff.
And what kind of things were you putting on demo? Were you creating your own little spots or sections or intros? I don't know what all the terminology is in radio, but were they little clips of hypotheticals or made up sort of role playing things that you would put on there?
No, it was basically just back announcing and forward announcing songs. You know, so it would just sound like the end of a song, and then you would come on, and then you would throw to a song, and you just do that a few times. But yeah, like, you would make up scenarios. My demo was, because I wasn't at a radio station, was just a fake radio station name, and it was really simple. It was, you tease that a competition's coming up, or you tease something that happened on the breakfast show, or it's just radio basics, really. And because I didn't have a radio station to work at the time, mine was probably the most basic of all demos, because it was completely fake. It was made up, and I had no idea what I was doing, but it was good enough to get me in the door. So
that's it. I mean, I guess you could have held off and just, thought, well, other people out there have got the equipment and the expertise, and that's who you're up against, but our stuffer, just throw your hat in the ring and see what happens.
Yeah. And that's all I could do, and I had a very supportive family at the time. Well, they still are supportive of what I'm doing, but they couldn't believe that I would sit there, night after night, making up these bloody boxes and getting them all good and looking fantastic, and then going up to the post office and sending them all off. And, you get to know the people at the post office as well. Oh, another round going out. Yeah. Still haven't got a gig, but I'm still trying. So.
And so when you eventually got the, you got the green light to go to Lithgow, I mean, it's kind of like the police force or even the schooling system, where you get stationed in a rural place and you gotta get your cred together and your experience, and then you prove yourself, and then you sort of gives you a bit of leverage to get better opportunities. So it's sort of like going out into rural Australia and really sort of, finding your feet.
Yeah, I don't know if you've been to Lithgow, Andy, but it's a shithole.
I just know it's really cold there. That's all.
Man, it's cold, and it's not much of a town. It's remarkably, because it is such a small kind of place, you make friends first with the people at the radio station, then you make friends with their friends, and then, you quickly grow a network. But it's the same over and over in a small town like that. You don't go anywhere. You drink at the same pubs all the time. You're with the same people all the time. it gets pretty depressive, and you just got to go, right, I need to get the hell out of here. So, yeah, 9 months later, I was gone. So I didn't hang around.
And so where'd you go after Lithgow?
Horsham in Victoria.
And that would have been a similar sort of setup as far as, you know, demographic and surroundings and limited things to do.
Yeah, but it was only 3 hours from home, which was good. A much bigger town, better studios. It was definitely a step up, but I was only there for 6 weeks.
Oh, six weeks?
Yeah. Unfortunately, while I was there, it was a friend's 21st back in Melbourne.
Right.
And so I came back for the party, and the Sunday morning I got a phone call from another friend who was at the party saying that the girl whose party I was at last night, her boyfriend had just died in a car accident.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I went around there and everyone was still there and, you know, we were grieving all together, and then we found out that the funeral was going to be on the following Friday, and I said, do you need a hand? She said, yes. And I said, okay, well, I'll call work and tell them that I'm staying down here, because he was obviously a friend of all of ours. Mm. And I said, the funeral's on the Friday, I'll be back the following Monday. And they begrudgingly said, why can't you come back for the week? And they wanted me to go back and then go back down for the funeral. Mm. So I just stayed down there. And then when I got back, I don't know, my mind wasn't in it.
Yeah.
And, I was hired down there to do drive. And when I got there, it turned out I'd be paddling 3 hours at John Laws on the AM station every morning, which means we take the show and I just push the buttons from this side.
Yeah.
And then I'm writing some copy, and then I'm emptying the bins, and you're doing 13, 14-hour days, mm. which is to be expected when you first started in radio. You know, you've got to learn a little bit of everything. But I was just getting taken advantage of. And one night, as I was receiving the night show, we used to get recorded and sent from Traralgon in Victoria. It used to go out to the network, so you used to have to sit there and record it in. Of a night time, and apparently I had let something go through. Someone had said fuck, and I didn't pick up on it.
Yeah.
And this had been sent out to the network, and then that was my fault, and I was dismissed.
Ugh.
So then you kind of go, okay, well, now what do? You pack up all your stuff. I hired a horse trailer and packed all my stuff in on the Friday and drove back to Melbourne.
Wow.
Then I started again, and it was like, okay, well, I've been in this position before. You just start again. But I was lucky. I was only back home for now I had a proper demo, and I had, you know, a lot more experience, even if how many months was that? In 9 or 10 months, I had more experience than you could imagine. Like, it was, you're pretty much fast tracking once you're in a station and you're doing everything.
Yeah, I guess you get thrown in the deep end to an extent, as far as, you know, learning as you go, and it's very hands on. You're not sitting there trying to learn a bunch of theory and then get into the practical side, you know, months down the track. You've pretty much just got to dive in.
Oh, well, I remember when I was in Lithgow, the boss came down and said, hey, Wayne, who's going to be, I think his name was Wayne, who was the production guy, he's going away for a week. So, can you do production for the week? And I said, I have no idea how to do production. And he was running, this is not on a computer either. He was running like a 16 track tape to tape machine. That's how his ads were made. And you had to drop edit. And so there was another thing I had to learn how to do. And, that was literally, it's sink or swim. And luckily enough, I got the hang of it after watching this bloke do it a few times. I learned how to do it, but, yeah, that's just one of the examples. And that happened again when I went to Mandurah in Western Australia. It was just crazy.
So how long was it between leaving Horsham and then heading over to Mandurah? Because was that the next one?
Yeah. When I got back to Melbourne, my sister actually rang me and she said, Fox FM are doing a jock-free weekend and they're taking submissions. And after going there and getting a job at Fox, I soon discovered that a jock-free weekend meant that all the jocks and all the programming staff would go to the snow for the weekend. So they would hire just any Joe Bloggs off the street to do an hour, you would go in and record it, and it would get played out over the weekend.
Right.
So my sister said, oh, you should give that a go. You get a new demo. And I said, okay. It's not a bad idea. So you had to ring and leave a message on an answering service, and that was enough to get someone's attention, and then they called and said, come in, and I recorded my hour pretty quickly. And they said, actually, I remember them saying at the time, geez, this is the quickest, you know, we've ever had anyone record this. And I said, oh, well, I've been doing radio for about, you know, 10 or 8 months. And they go, oh, right, oh, okay. So you do radio. And I told them where, and they went, oh, right, okay. So just Lithgow and Horsham, right. No, so nothing nothing really impressive. And then that following Saturday, I had to wake up and record it off my own stereo because I knew what, you know, songs I was talking into and out of. Mm. And so that was my new demo.
Nice.
And that's when I sent it off to Mandurah. So the time between Horsham and Mandurah was mid-May and then to July. Yeah, so I was only back home for like a month and a half, 2 months.
That's pretty good. I mean, and to also have that opportunity, like right time, right place, to be able to get a professional demo done for free.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. It sounded much better than the one I was shopping around at the time.
And so, did you have to do the same thing?
And also, because it says Fox FM on it, it sounds a bit more legit. Yeah. So
absolutely. Yeah. Did you have to go through, I mean, even though it was a short space of time, but did you have to go through that exact same process as you'd done 10, 12 months earlier with sending out all those demo tapes? You did the same thing again?
Yeah.
And obviously, it didn't take 40 plus this time. It was a few less.
Yeah, it was a few less. It was probably, I reckon it was... there was a job in Geelong, which I was spewing I didn't get because that was super close to home. Then there was one in Murray Bridge in South Australia that I didn't get. And then actually I got a call from someone up way up north. I think it might have been Charleville again because they were kind of hunting around. And then that came at the same time as the Mandurah one. And I thought, I mean, if I'm going to go north or west, I've never been to WA, so I'm going to go west. And it's only an hour out of Perth. So I thought, well, that'll be probably a better place to learn. So, yeah, packed up the car and drove across.
Oh, and, I mean, knowing that you're going to be travelling so far away from Melbourne, I mean, how did that sit with you at the time? Or was it just more exciting that you landed an opportunity?
When you're young, it was definitely excitement. It was, you know, I was shit scared like anyone would be. But I'd never driven that far. I'd never been to WA. I had spoken briefly with the boss there, and he wanted me to do breakfast with this other girl. So I'd never done that before. So I was, super excited to get over there and give it a crack, which was great. And plus my uncle was, and still is, in Perth. So I got to see him. I hadn't seen him in ages. And, it was a good time. That was probably the best move I did, apart from obviously getting my foot in the door. But that was where going to Mandurah was definitely where I found who I was going to be on air, and really, really found my niche, I guess, and found some good mentors, which was really good.
Well, I heard a sample or a few samples from your days over in WA. I know you put up a couple of or three or four of the lost tapes on your YouTube channel.
Oh yeah, the stupid little crap co skits,
Lifefest Entertainment System.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. No, quite good. So, I mean, over that time, and you mentioned mentors. I mean, were there people that were working in the station, or was it just people that you met over there that sort of gave you a few life lessons, or is it more radio specific? I mean, what did that look like?
Well, they were kind of indirect mentors because there was a guy, and I'm still friends with Wayne, who was working at the AM station when I was there, and he had worked in radio. He's quite a few years older than me, but he was just so good at being on air, and especially in a talk format. He still is. It's so natural, and his interview style was fantastic, and I used to listen to him, and he wouldn't know, but I used to listen to him and not try and emulate, but just I learnt so much by listening to him. And then, you know, of course, you've got access to Capital City Radio, so you can listen to Perth then, and I tried to get some people from Perth Radio to, you know, give me some advice. And by now... I don't think I was tapes now. I might have started sending MP3s by then. So when I was in Mandurah, I started sending them back to the jocks who were on air at Fox FM in Melbourne. Mm. I thought, well, that's where I want to go. So that's, if you want to aspire to something, you may as well go straight to them. And then a guy called Craig Bruce was the assistant program director, I think, at the time. And he started giving me some feedback. So he obviously heard something. And he would give me and he still has this incredible ability to give you such great feedback, but will also smack you around the head and tell you that that what you're doing is wrong, but in the nicest possible way.
Yeah.
His ability to talk to people like that is enviable. I wish I had that kind of – and it's funny because years later you do air check people from the country and you think, okay, what did Craig tell me? How do I shape this so I'm not going to crush someone by telling them they suck? And he just has that ability to nurture rather than, you know, just say, nah, you're no good. He hears something, he latches onto that, and he grows it from that central point. And that was probably the biggest thing. We would trade emails and stuff every 4 weeks or so, and I would send him back. You know, he'd give me a couple of pointers to work on, and then I would send them back, and he would see that I'm getting better or whatever, or implementing his ideas. And, he became a long-distance teacher.
What was the biggest thing that you learned in that time as far as what was something that you didn't realize that you needed to work on or something that he identified at that point in time?
I think brevity was probably, which I'm totally ignoring while we're doing this and just rambling on. But it's a few things that sort of stay with you throughout your radio career. Get in, get to the gold, get out. Don't waffle on.
Yeah.
Unless something is deserving of some waffling, but that still stands today. Mm. And it was something that I didn't really know about until I got there. Crafting your breaks to make them sound the way they should. And it's a bit of a dark art and it's hard to explain without me waffling on, but yeah, you kind of learn brevity is important sometimes. Leave them wanting more.
That's it. A little bit of mystery.
Yeah.
So how long were you over there for?
I was there for 16 months.
Okay, so that's a fair chunk of time. Were you already, as you said before, when you went to Lithgow and then went to Horsham, when you went over to WA, were you already thinking about, okay, when can I get out or when's that next thing? Or were you sort of fixated or cemented in your mind that you're going to be here for a decent period of time?
I don't know. Yeah, I didn't get the same feeling as I did when I went to Lithgow or Horsham. It's a very comfortable place to live, Mandurah, because the weather is fantastic. The people are really nice. And I was living right across the road from the radio station in a place that was costing me bugger all in rent and had a pool. And, you're a big fish in a small pond in a place like that. So there was a lot of outside work, so you get a bit of extra cash. I was riding into my car at that stage, so Kwinana Motorplex was about 40 minutes up the road. That had just opened, so I was drag racing nearly every weekend, and I got a girlfriend while I was over there, and, you know, life was starting to settle.
Mm.
But with that chatting to Craig, I was more comfortable staying there while I was talking to Craig. I thought, he's my foot in, so as soon as he says it's time to jump, then I would make inroads. I wasn't talking to anyone else. I wasn't sending out any applications while I was over there. I was in touch with him and I thought, this is my ticket, and if he's going to go, he will put me in the right direction to talk to someone else. So,
did he give you a lead or gave you a whiff of something to pursue once you got to that sort of 16-month period?
No, he called and offered me a job.
Oh, he just offered you straight off the bat.
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, well, that's a moment you never forget, standing in the lounge room on a Friday afternoon and the phone ringing and, you know, hi, Dave, it's Craig. And you go, oh, yeah, hello, mate, there you go. Yeah, good. Mate, how would you feel about coming over here and doing Mid-Dawns on Fox? And you're like, look, I'll just call the girlfriend and make sure.
Do the right thing.
And I did. I got off the phone and I called her. She's a hairdresser, so I called her at work. I said, look, I've just been offered a job in Melbourne. And she goes, oh, you've got to take it.
Oh,
and I said, okay, well, I'll call you back with the details. And I rang him straight back and said, yeah, I'm in. And he said, did you really ring your girlfriend? And I said, yeah, I did. I said, because she's from here and I wanted to make sure that she was okay.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, a couple of weeks later. And look, I'm skipping over for some details here. While I was in Mandurah, my mum was diagnosed with cancer. And then, so this was all going to tie in nicely because I was coming home.
Mm.
And then 2 weeks before we were due to leave, my car got stolen and written off. So I bought a trailer to pack all that stuff in. So, yeah, there was a couple of little hiccups, but that's all they were, a little couple of hiccups. And then, you know, we got back over here and got a house and started the job.
Well, and just sort of just try to get into the swing of things.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where you kind of go, you can really let it become a roadblock, or you can, you know, take a different route. So we just sold the wreck of the car, made some money like that, and then, you know, the most important thing, I was back here and got a gig on the station that I was trying to get a gig on, and was home close to mum.
And you're pretty much, I mean, from there, that point, I mean, you've pretty much been sort of based in Melbourne, doing work in Melbourne since then.
Oh, not really. No. I was in Melbourne from January. Well, I got back in December of 2001, started at Fox in January of 2002. Mum passed away in March of 2002. And then in September of that year, I got the call up to go to Sydney, Today FM, and work with Kyle and Jackie O. On, they were doing the Hot 30 Countdown.
Ah, oh, there you go.
Yeah, so I went up there for 6 months. I packed the girlfriend up. We moved up there, and then that job sort of that job fell over in the new year. And then I got a call from Triple M back here, and they said, can you come in and fill in for us for a while? I said, absolutely. So I told the missus, look, I've got to go back to Melbourne. You stay up here because I don't know how long I'm going to be. And then I got down there, and this job was sort of leading to something. And I said, look, what do you want to do? And she said, I think I'm going to move back to WA. And so by this stage, it's close to May 2003. And and then I get another phone call. Do you want to come to Newcastle? And I thought, well, it's a full-time gig. Crazy not to. And so I drove back up the Hume to Sydney. Saw the outgoing girlfriend, and she said, look, you know, there was no hard feelings. It was completely amicable. And I said, I know it's tough being on the road. She's far away from her family. And I totally got it. And I was just in a different headspace, and she couldn't really put up with following someone around the country. That was cool. I just gave her everything out of the house. I didn't care because I wanted to travel light. Up I went to Newcastle, to NXFM. So it was a bit of a turbulent few months.
Is that the norm for a lot of people in the radio sort of field, where it's a lot of sort of stationed for relatively small periods of time, unless you get an amazing opportunity where you get nicely looked after and you find your little spot on a prime time sort of spot? You know, is that sort of the nature of the job, where it's just sort of, you know, short spaces of time and you could find yourself anywhere?
Yeah, I think it is for a lot of people. Well, it was, certainly was back then, and I still believe it should be that way as well for people learning, is to you know, just to take every opportunity that was given to them. And that's certainly the way that I looked at it, was whatever was offered to me, I just said yes, because I wanted to progress. And sometimes it wasn't always, well, sometimes it didn't feel like a forward step. It was maybe a sideways one, but you never know who you're going to learn from. And you were always, always learning. And any chance that I had to apply my craft, I wanted to take that opportunity. So going to Newcastle is another place I'd been to briefly when I was in Sydney, but I thought my dad spoke highly of it. That's where he was born, and I thought, well, yeah, bugger it, I'll go to Newcastle, and just made the most amazing friends there, who I'm still friends with to this day. But that was another short tenure. That was 5 months.
Yeah.
So 5 months up there, but it's weird when you're in a radio gig. Those short times, they feel like forever. Like the 9 months in Lithgow felt forever. And Horsham was literally a blink of an eye. But Mandurah, 16 months, it just flew by. It really did. And Newcastle was the same. It's just your head's in a spin, and you're so engrossed in the radio station and what you're doing and trying to get better. So you're always talking to people, and you're going to functions and you're networking. And it just, I must have seemed like I was out of control, which I probably was, to be fair. After Mum died, I was kind of on the run. You know, I didn't want to face it and kind of spiraled a little bit there for a while. But I just kept pouring myself into work. And while it was doing me great favors work-wise, mental health was deteriorating fast. But you just keep masking that and keep moving forward.
Well, and I'll get to some of that in this too, because I've made a couple of notes about that. But you know, working in radio is one of those things, and there's probably a few other lines of work that could run parallel. But it's such a unique environment to work in, because there's obviously the whole communication aspect of the job, but you have to, no matter what you're doing in the station, you have to interact with other people. I mean, that's just, it seems to be part of that. Part of the job, you know, and so there's this massive social aspect where people are, you know, whether they like it or not, have to get out of their shell and communicate and work together as a team. But you are communicating, and you're connecting with not only the people that you work with, but the wider community, because they're all tuning in as well. So as you said before, attending different things and interacting with the local area, and especially when you're doing those regional stints, you know, where everybody knows each other, and within no doubt probably a few weeks everybody knew who you were, and you knew most of the people, or the people to know, or the people to avoid. And it's just it's one of those unique things where I think, you know, if you were doing a manual job or something that was sort of a little bit more sort of straight down the barrel, you probably wouldn't have those types of experiences. You wouldn't be pushing yourself all the time. And I think there'd be a lot of sort of personality things that you'd be pushing yourself out of your comfort zone all the time in each stint that you embark on.
Yeah, I think it takes a particularly crazy kind of person to do it. We're all a little bit sort of unhinged in their own unique way, and that's not just people on air either. That's people who work in all facets of radio. You've got to have that personality, because you are interacting, as you said, with people every single day in all walks of life, and you've just got to. Yeah, you constantly. I don't know. You don't crave it. I was going to say you crave it, but you don't crave it. But you enjoy it. You enjoy talking to people, and you enjoy finding out other people's stories, and you know, and just socializing. And it suits a certain style of people. But yeah, we're all definitely a little bit crazy in that regard.
It's a form of curiosity, just wanting to be inquisitive and find out something from somebody else. And like, because I
think so.
I know people like. That are the opposite of that and could not care less about anybody else, and the less interacting with other human beings, the better. So,
yeah, that's my housemate.
Oh, right. There you go, chalk and cheese.
Yeah. Oh, right. He doesn't talk to any bastard. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't give a stuff. He's happy in his own little world. And, we really are complete fucking chalk and cheese. It's ridiculous. He doesn't go and talk to people. Like, you know, he has his group of friends, and we share a lot of the similar friends. We've known each other for 30 some years. So, hang on. I've got another call coming in. Can you hang on for a sec?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Hang on there.
All right, we're back. Okay, what are we talking about? Crazy people working in radio. Okay. Now, actually, this is not a very good segue, because you were talking earlier about some of the challenges that you had leaving Perth, and then a lot of those things that you had to go through with your mother. And one thing that I was doing a little bit of internet stalking, and I remember you putting this up when Robin Williams passed away, and you did an article, and you wrote about depression, and you sort of spoke about some of, I guess, the years earlier and things that have sort of led up to around that time. And when obviously all this news came about what the way that Robin Williams passed away, that it was, I'm assuming that you felt it was a good time to talk about a lot of this stuff and bring a lot of this conversation more into the public domain. Now, unfortunately, the article that you wrote was on the Triple M website, but has now since disappeared. So
yeah.
I was going to ask you, did you publish that anywhere else, or have you republished that anywhere else?
I don't think I did, not in full. I know that news.com.au ran the story, which kind of paraphrased it a bit, but the meat and potatoes of it was still there.
Yeah, that's what I read. Yeah, and I mean, that was 4 years ago that came out, and obviously a lot of the things that you'd gone through has been sort of right back, you know, to the early 2000s and no doubt there's probably a whole bunch of other things that you've experienced like most of us through our lives. But, I mean, 4 years on, you know, thinking back at that time when you wrote that article and, you know, reflecting, I mean, is what's life like these days? And I guess in general, in the way that your perception of those sort of issues being talked about in the public domain?
For me personally, life is a lot better. But the conversation still needs to be had. It was interesting. The AFL footy show was on last night and they had Alistair Clarkson, the coach of the Hawthorn Football Club, on, and the conversation was brought up again. And that was really pleasing to see. I actually tweeted about that. I'm glad they brought it up because, you know, one of the most butchered sports, it'll be the same as the NRL as well. You need people talking about it. We need to break down the stigmas and we need to break down the barriers because it's completely normal. You know, you go to any office environment where there's 150 odd people and you can guarantee that more than half would be having some issues in one sort of respect or another. So, you know, it's for some reason it's taboo. It was seen as a weakness, and the attitude is slowly changing. So it's really good. But I was running from it. I didn't want bosses to know in 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005 that I was suffering from this. I didn't really know, to be honest. But I was masking it with a lot of things. So it wasn't until 2011 that I actually, you know, had that breakthrough when I went and actually saw someone about it. Which also is outlined in that story. It was a pretty horrific day, and I can't imagine. And the other thing was, only about maybe a year ago, my dad was changing phones, and for whatever reason, the messages from the day when I sort of lost my shit came up on his phone because I was trying to talk to him.
Oh God, panic!
Yeah, and I looked through these messages and went, shit, I'm really sorry. I apologized to him. I said, how did you deal with this? Because some of those messages were just frightening. You know, you're right on the ragged edge, and I didn't realize that what I would... I can't imagine. Like, I was writing them, but I don't really remember writing them. And then I can't imagine him as a parent getting those messages. You know, it would have just sent him into a bloody meltdown.
But it's one of those things where when you're in those moments and, I've certainly from, you know, my own personal experiences had moments where you sort of lose track of everything and you lose clarity and focus and where you sit in the world. And I don't know to what extent, and, you know, I'm horrible. I mean, I compare myself and my experiences to everybody. And usually that can be, I don't do it in always the most positive of ways, and it's usually pretty damaging. But I'm assuming that when, like, even just the way you described that you're not thinking at that point in time. It's so clouded, you've got no sense of focus or sort of direction, and it's sort of just, especially if you've been bottling things up for a while or running from something, you know, when things start to leak out or explode, I mean, it's not a case of having any sort of awareness of anything really. It's just coming out.
Yeah, it was a pretty dark time in 2011, and I know the bosses at work didn't deal with it too well either. It was a pretty harrowing time, but it was also a tremendous breakthrough, and that's the way I kind of look at it now, as a really positive moment, because if I hadn't have had that moment, then maybe I would have still been running, or maybe I wouldn't be here at all. And, you know, going to get help was the hardest but also the most rewarding thing I've ever done, because I'm in a better place now than I've been in, you know, 20 years.
Do you see that, I mean, going through that, and many people don't even get to that point, unfortunately, do you have a lot more clarity, and can you see a lot more around you in the way that other people hold themselves and the way that they act and converse with others? Can you see, or have you got a bit more awareness of people around you now than you did beforehand?
I've certainly got a more awareness of how I talk around people. And I, again, you look back at how I must have seemed to people back then, being short and curt with them and you know, just vacant, I reckon, a lot of the time as well. But I see that in my friends sometimes, and that's when you just go and ask them. You drag them aside and ask them if they're okay. And I think that's the other thing that's made me hyper aware, is asking a lot of my friends if they're doing okay. Mm. And not that my friends didn't. They probably did ask me if I was all right, and I probably just said, yeah, I'm fine. No worries, you know.
Yeah.
Because we're blokes, and that's what we do, because we're idiots.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think I'm just a little bit more hyper-aware, and it also made me aware of what my triggers were.
Mm.
That, you know, certain things. And you get to realizing what you actually love doing in life. And I think because I was chasing the dream and trying to be the very best I could, I wasn't giving any time to myself. I was handing it out to others.
Mm.
And always being the sounding board, or the, you know, the rock, trying to be the rock. If someone else had a problem, you just, you know, don't worry, come and talk to me. And you take on other people's burdens, and then you just, it gets too much.
I think
having time for yourself is super important.
Well, I've heard a few people say it. I don't know where it originated from, but you got to be selfish to be selfless, and I think you've got to get your own sort of backyard, you know, in order before you're best equipped to help other people. And otherwise, yeah, I mean, you end up destroying yourself, and sometimes you even destroy other people as well, because you're not best equipped to be able to handle the situation. But
yeah, I think when people hear that sort of saying, you've got to be selfish, they hear selfish as such a negative word. Thing. But
that's right.
Yeah, but it's maybe selfish isn't the word, but I guess it is, because you've got to look after yourself, and looking after yourself is selfish. But it's just taking care of, you know, your inner. I'm going to get all hippie here, but it's just taking care of yourself. You've just got to go, hang on a minute, why do I keep saying yes to things that I don't want to do?
Mm.
Or, you know, you're just going to say, okay, respectfully, I need some time, and go and do something that you enjoy.
That's it.
You know, I think that's why Perth was, you know, or Mandra was that good, because I was doing stuff that I enjoyed, and I had a girlfriend who enjoyed doing it with me, and, you know, I had good people around me. The drag racing was a huge part of my life, and I still love it. And I had to rediscover it, because I stopped doing it. And it was, it's funny stuff. And even the simplest things, like I love going to the movies, but I just stopped doing it. And I thought, why did I stop going to the movies? I like that. So you start doing it again, and yeah, I really like this. And it's those little things. And that's what I mean by being selfish. Go and do things that you like to do that make you happy.
That's it. And the most, I mean, you know, when you say it and, you know, they feel so trivial and so small, but they have such a dramatic impact. And it's just giving yourself the breathing space and time to have a break, and whatever that break means, you know, that's up to the individual, but it's just giving yourself that opportunity to take a step back for a moment and just sort of breathe for a second.
It could be, you know what, this weekend I'm going to stay home and watch bloody Netflix all weekend under the dune on the couch. Then do it.
Yeah.
You know, if that's what you need to do. It, like you said, it's completely individual.
When you put that article out, did you get a lot back? I mean, obviously, I saw a few publications repost at news.com.au, and I saw a couple of others that sort of spun it out as well. But did you get much from, I don't know, friends and family, or just even the general public?
Yeah. I remember before posting it, I ran it by the boss, and he said, there will be, you know, you're going to get feedback from this.
Mm.
And he goes, you just got to be prepared. And I wouldn't have done it unless I'd been fully prepared. And I think that's why I hadn't done it earlier.
Mm.
I think because I wasn't mentally ready for the challenge.
Mm.
And the feedback and it was just overwhelmingly positive and supportive.
Mm.
Incredibly supportive. Like, I don't think I remember seeing one negative comment from anywhere on any media forum directed at me, or, you know, indirectly at me. I had nothing but, you know, positivity.
Must be reassuring. I mean, no doubt by that stage when you were putting that together, you'd already sort of built. I'm just making assumptions left, right, and center here, but you must have already sort of built a lot of reassurance, knowing that a lot of other people go through similar things that you've gone through.
Mm.
But to have that sort of validation and that sort of feedback and positive feedback and support, no doubt would have been this additional, you know, confirmation that, you know, the way that you feel is completely normal, and so many other people go through the same sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I'd seen other stories like it, and it's a big thing. You you see sports people or other personalities, and their stories in Women's Day or whatever. You know, there's people out on the trail raising awareness, and I thought there is a change happening, and I want to be part of that positive change. Mm. And I think now is as good a time as any. Buck up and get the story out there and spread it. And the more, I encourage more people to do it, because it is empowering to those around us. And, you know, all I wanted to achieve with that is, as I said in the article, I wasn't looking for pity, because that's not what I do. Mm. I wasn't looking for sympathy or anything like that. I was looking for positive change and just to reassure people that you're not alone. No one's ever alone. The world's a better place with you in it. Let's talk about it. Let's be open about it. And we can help each other. And I think that's something that I still stand by. It's, and especially in the music community, you would know there's a lot of people who have done it hard, and we've lost a lot of people along the way.
I have, certainly. And it's, I've seen people recently this year, you know, unfortunately take their lives, and I don't know. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm so ignorant and naive to it, because I think that I know people, and I think I understand people, and I think that there's no way. And then you see something that completely shocks you, and somebody that, you know, on the surface ticks all the boxes in life, you know, everything's going for them. They, you know, and, you know, from anybody else looking in, it looks like everything's just completely fine and great. And then they're not there anymore. And you sort of just scratch your head going, man, I thought that I had this worked out, this whole human thing worked out. And then you get thrown this curveball, and you just think, wow, like, you know, what do I take out of that? And, you know, I might be completely fine or feel that I'm fine, but, you know, when I look around at all my friends and people that are always smiling and cheering and really happy and have everything going for them, are they okay? And then you sort of think, well, should I be asking this more often, even though they appear to be completely fine? Or maybe there are warning signs there that I'm not noticing. And then you start to really sort of overthink it. But it's just, it's one of those things where it's such a scary thing, and it's a dangerous, I mean, clearly a dangerous thing, but, you know, that it can lay dormant and it can sit underneath and people hide it. Then there's a natural tendency and a human instinct to hide these things because it's had such a heavy stigma forever.
Well, it's the heavy stigma involved, but it's also people not wanting to be a burden on anyone else. I think that's more of an underlying thing that, you know, everyone's got their own problems. Why would I want to dump mine on someone else? And then so you just live with it and suck it up. And that's debilitating. That's the hard part. And that's why you go and see a professional, because that's their job to take it all in. But, yeah, sometimes you just notice something with one of your mates, and it could just be something small, like, you know, there's obviously there might be something wrong at work or something at home. But, you know, you just think, hey, you doing all right?
Yeah.
And that's all it takes.
Yeah, sometimes it's just something very simple that could just, you know, shock the system momentarily, where someone snaps out of something, you know, just even for a moment, just, and that just changes their course just for a short space of time and gets them away from something that could be much worse. But it's certainly something that, I don't know. I mean, I think like most males, and I'll focus on males because that's the best way, or, you know, that's the best experience I've got. But, you know, for a lot of guys going through adolescence and you know, later teens and into early sort of manhood, you know, we've got these stigmas, and we're not sort of encouraged to talk about a lot of these things, and it's better to be strong and get on with things and not be such a wuss and take it all in your stride. And that was sort of always been the, I don't know, the association with being a man and what being a male is all about. And I certainly have my struggles getting older and becoming an adult and trying to work out where I fit into the world. But it's just one of those things that keeps popping up every once in a while. And you sort of think, okay, I think I need to do a little bit more about this. I think I need to speak about it a little bit more. I think I need to check in with people. And I think we just get into autopilot with our own lives and just forget about, you know, what other people might be going through.
Mm. Yeah, there's certainly this, it's a generational thing, I think, with guys as well. Just throwing back to that moment on the footy show last night where Sam Newman, who's now in his 70s, I guess, he said, this didn't seem to be around when I was a younger man. And Matty Maguire was quick to jump in and said, oh, it was around, but everyone was just masking it and told them not to talk about it. Mm. And people were hiding it with alcohol or drugs or whatever. But it's definitely a generational thing, and that's why slowly over time we are now talking about it, and kids are talking about it, and that's great. You know, especially young men. That's been the biggest thing. I think women don't have any problem at all, and I'm generalizing. They generally don't have any problem at all telling you exactly how they feel. That's enviable. Yeah. But guys will, you know, what do you think about? Nothing. And we're not generally thinking about anything at all, but, you know, sometimes when we say nothing, we really are. And that's the dangerous sort of gray area, because we've always been told to lock it down and get on with it, you know. And funnily enough, after Mum died, and that's kind of how Dad was, you know, because he's old school. Mm. You know, you just get on with it, just get on with life. And yeah, I couldn't, you know, and so I just had to find a way to get on with it, because I thought it was the right thing to do.
And that was, I mean, that was the unfortunate, I mean, obviously now in hindsight, you can see, you know, the value in what's happened and where you are now. But, you know, you had to take that unfortunate path of a few years there of really trying to work out, you know, what's going on, and, or not even trying to work it out, just putting your head down and running and just hoping that you survive.
Yeah, because you don't know what the hell to do, you know. After Mum died, there was the week between her death and the funeral, so you take that off work, and then you kind of go, all right, well, I'm going to decompress for maybe another week. Now what do? I just go back to work. So after 2 weeks, I went back to work, and they were all surprised to see me there. But I didn't want to – I thought I had to go back, because I didn't want to lose this opportunity. So you just get on with it. Mm. And you just keep striving for the next thing. And yeah, it's one of those things where, as I said earlier, man, we're pretty stupid when it comes to things like that.
I catch myself all the time. I mean, you know, when someone asks me what I'm thinking, or, you know, especially if I'm thinking about something where it's a little bit emotive and it's sitting under my skin and it might be boiling for whatever reason. And I know better, and I have enough life experience now and to know and understand when the right time and the right things to say. But I struggle, and I can feel it, where you're trying, there's this invisible wall where you need to sort of break through it or jump over it to get past this feeling of, this awkward feeling where it just doesn't feel natural. It doesn't feel right to talk about your feelings. And so we do exactly what you said before. You just turn around and say, oh yeah, no, it's fine. Or nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. Because it's just, otherwise everything else is just too hard, or it's just too awkward, or it's just too uncomfortable, or just not natural. It just doesn't, and it is natural. I mean, it should be natural, but it just feels, and it's, I don't know whether that's something just ingrained in a lot of us guys, or that's something that's, you know, I'm experiencing my own unique version of that. But when.
No, it's uncomfortable because you're being vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that's a really difficult thing to do, is to show anyone a softer side, or, you know, being, as blokes, being open to ridicule. Mm. Unless you have a really good circle of friends who wouldn't do that to you when you're trying to be serious, especially if you're known as a bit of a, you know, a clown, and we all are around our mates. Mm. So if all of a sudden someone goes, you're all right, you go, no, not really. Mm. And then they say, what's up? And then you go on a rant about why you're not feeling well mentally. They probably go, geez, have another beer. Harden up, you know, and that's not what you're looking for. So you don't open up because you're being vulnerable. And, yeah, it's a catch-22. But we are changing that, and I like it. I've got a couple of friends who, you know, reach out every now and again, and it's, you know, you have a few confidants that you can talk to, and they won't, you know, you're safe, basically. And it's reciprocated as well.
Oh, that's it. I mean, it goes, and that's the big thing, because, you know, that catch-22 situation of opening up and then potentially putting yourself in a vulnerable position where you get that kind of feedback from somebody, it's about setting the example and leading, and, you know, treating other people with the perspective of going, well, this is how I would want to be treated when I'm in that position, and when I'm in that unfortunate period of time where things aren't feeling the best. And when I'm feeling better, then I want to be able to be the best that I can to support other people and hopefully lead. And that's a hard thing to do, but it's having that awareness to be clear and be awake in a way while things are great, so that when things aren't as great, you're not completely sort of out of control.
Mm. Yeah, it's it's so tough. It is. Yeah, it's tough because we mere mortals, we don't know the proper way to handle it. And, you know, doctors do, obviously, and that's what they're trained to do, and psychiatrists and what have you. But you just kind of go, "What if you had a mate come to you? You don't know how to act. You don't know what to say. What am I supposed to do? How do I support you? I want to support you, but I don't know what to do." And rather than say all that, people just go, "I don't know."
Mm.
You know, if someone, and you just go, "Well, I don't know." Some people need just someone to listen to them, and other people need a hug, and other people need advice. It's impossible. And I think that all, you know, bundled up with the stigma, with the vulnerability, you know, and the get on with it, you know, attitude that we're having, the generational stuff, all that makes it very difficult for men to move forward with those issues. So
that might be the next gap. I mean, because, I mean, I know over the last several years there's been a lot of talk about mental health and encouraging guys in particular, but anybody to utilise things like Beyond Blue and Lifeline and all these great resources. And it's all about expressing the way that you feel to somebody else. But, and I know that we've got, you know, Are You Okay Day, which is on the flip side, but maybe there needs to be more of a focus of teaching people and equipping people, not to be, you know, counselors or anything like that, but just some basic skills of, so people feel a little bit more confident when they are listening to somebody else's, you know, troubles and being effective and to understand time and place. Because some people, and I'm definitely victim to this, I've always got a solution for everything, even if I'm talking out of my ass. Like, I'll always have an answer for anything. I'll make it up, whatever, I don't care. I'll find an answer. And sometimes people just don't need to hear anything. They just want to talk. They want to get it off their chest. And I've certainly identified that with myself, where that's a weak point, where sometimes I just need to shut the fuck up and just listen, and that's it. And I don't need to say anything. And then sometimes you need to say something. But that's a hard thing to do. And it does come down to the individual, the circumstances, everyone's personality, what works and what doesn't. But I don't know, maybe that's something that that needs to put a bit more of a focus in the public domain, is equipping people and giving people more of an understanding of how to be on that other side, you know, of the fence.
Yeah. There's smarter people who have the answers than me, but
me too.
From a common sense point of view, from my point of view, anyway, we should just be able to talk without judgment. But especially when it comes to stuff that's hurting inside you.
Yeah.
And as I said earlier, the world's a better place with you in it, rather than out of it. So that's the aim, is to keep everyone here. And not make them feel bad for feeling bad.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ooh. Well, I'll change the pace a little bit. And
okay.
I'm keeping an eye on the time as well. But I've got a few questions for you because, well, actually, it's a slight segue. Have you thought about doing anything in the vein of, I guess, your experiences and what you've done and writing that article, and that's going back about 4 years ago now. Have you thought about doing anything, you know, I guess, to in the public domain with, I don't know, the personality that you've created in radio as well, to, I don't know, to do anything in this sort of topic?
No, I'm inherently lazy.
Okay, fair enough.
So, that's the short answer. Yeah. No, not really. I haven't really, again, because I think there's probably more informed minds than mine. That doesn't mean that I couldn't learn more about it and, you know, punch out some facts and figures. And I'd be happy to do so, if it's going to help people. But no, it's not something that I have given a lot of thought to at all. Sometimes I just think there might be better people for the job.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it depends. I guess it depends on what the message is. I think even just the fact that you had that moment to decide to write that piece at that point in time, no doubt. And as you said before, I mean, you know, it was proof in the pudding. You had so much positive feedback from people. I think even just telling a story and telling your own experiences is way more than what a lot of other people are doing. So sometimes it's not about, you know, the specialization or the expertise or anything like that. It's just, you know, it's drawing it right back to the simplicity of human nature and human story and sharing that and not being afraid to talk about it. And I guess, you know, we're doing a little bit of that now as well. But When I read the article, which had a lot of, as you mentioned before, your original article paraphrased, and I was reading through it, and I just thought, this is, you know, I mean, a really full-on story, and there's a whole range of different things that we're building up and just coming from different directions. And I just think, wow, it's something that a lot of other people go through, and a lot of people have their own version of this, and something that a lot of people need to know and need to see this and go, oh, wow, like, I'm not in this dark hole where nobody can relate to me and no one understands what I'm going through. There are lots of people out there, and I guess working in the public domain the way that you do, I think I think people have got a natural tendency to look up to people that are out there publicly doing lots of different things. And so I think the fact that you made that decision back then, and the fact that we're talking about it, I'm referring back to it, and it's 4 years ago now, just shows how powerful it was and what it still is now.
Yeah, it's funny to tell that. Every now and again I'll get a tweet or something from someone who has found that article and it's helped them. And you just, because I forget sometimes, you know, you write something and it's just in your body of work that you've done, and you go, oh, yeah, I did write that thing. Yeah, well, yeah, you think, well, bloody awesome, but it's helped someone move on. And so, you know, just to flesh out that idea a bit further, I wouldn't mind going around to regional stations, or, you know, not so much, even capital city stations, I guess, and just talking with the people there and making them understand that, you know, that they are probably feeling stressed or a bit of anxiety, and it's completely normal. But going back to what you said, that everyone's had those dark holes. And one of the things you always get told is you're never alone. And I don't think until you have that breakthrough that you truly realize that you are not alone. Because when you're in your own little black hole, you can't see out. And that's the thing with depression. You can't see anything. Nothing is normal, and there are no solutions. There's no, you know, you're in a dark, for want of a better turn of phrase, you're in a dark room with no way out. And you just can't believe that you're not alone, because you just feel completely alone, and you tell yourself that there's no one doing it like I am at the moment. And it's rubbish. People, like you said, people have different, it might be just different things, but yeah, like you said, things come at you from all different angles, and all of a sudden you hit that bloody precipice of just wanting to explode. But everyone has that. And anyone who thinks that they don't is kidding themselves.
Yeah, and I think when we simplify things and start just talking about experiences and just talking about our own feelings, I think that's when it's probably more impactful and has more of a cut through. I think, obviously talking about the psychology behind it, and, you know, I mean, the two of us are certainly not equipped to be going down that rabbit hole. But, you know, I mean, there's certainly a place for that, and people can learn a lot more about, you know, the human makeup and why we do the things that we do and why we think particular ways. And we can go back, you know, generational and culture and tradition and things that have embedded in our minds and even in genetics. But, I mean, in the end, it's the simplicity of just talking and conversing and sharing stories. And through that, you know, indirectly sometimes it can be that breakthrough moment for somebody where they're listening to somebody else talk and they go, oh, shit, I don't know what happened just then, but something just broke through. And there's a crack of light, and that's enough for me to keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I just keep thinking about that bloody, you know, doing something in a public sense now that you've mentioned it. And it's, you've got to be comfortable in talking about it, and not everyone is. And I'm totally comfortable with it. But that took up until that point of 2014 or whatever it was, you know, I was still running away, you know, 3 years after being medicated. But it was, you know, times change, and you realize you've got to own it and, kick on. And that's when you do get on with it, you know. You go, right, oh, well, this is me. I'm owning it, and hopefully I can help people with it.
Well, that's it. I mean, you it's all, oh, this is me getting a bit hippie, but it's all energy, you know, and it's negative energy. And then if you can harness that and flip it around and turn it into something positive using that same, energy, then, I mean, that's the way to live. And that's very difficult for a lot of people to do because they've got to understand what it all is first. But once you do and you can turn something around, then, well, life gets a hell of a lot better, but it's getting people to that first point, which is the critical thing. I'll pester you with some of my ideas at a later time and give you some things to ponder over. But I thought I'd plant those seeds because when I was reading that, I just thought, oh wow, like that's, I mean, you are fortunate with what you have done and what you've achieved over the years and being in that domain and having a lot of people identify and know you, and especially in music. I mean, shit, you know, somebody that's in the rock world and the people that you've spoken to over the years and most people know you and associate you with your time at Triple M and mm-hmm. your heavy involvement in the music scene, especially the metal scene in Melbourne and putting on all your fests and these great shows. I mean, you have, and whether you sort of really think about this or not, you have a lot of direct connection with so many people that are like-minded, and they're also a heavily, unfortunately, heavily male-dominated clique of people, which is changing, and it's balancing out a lot more now than it ever has before. But it's still very male-dominated, and yeah. You know, all these people have the same things that we've been speaking about, and I don't know, there could be something there to think about.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're absolutely right.
So, before I wrap it up, and I think you potentially going to answer this the same way as what you answered with before, but there were a few things that you were doing about a year ago that I got really, really excited about and then just kind of stopped. So, yeah. Distortion, the podcast, is that coming back?
Yes, it will. But again, it's kind of life gets in the way. And my focus shifted.
Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed doing it, but it's just, yeah, I'm concentrating at the moment of getting back into radio.
Yeah.
You know, in a full term capacity. So that's kind of taking my focus at the moment. But it will return. I've just got to time manage better because I know a lot of people do like it. And I enjoy doing it.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, that just validates some of the things I said before as far as the way that you've cemented yourself and connected with so many people. And I think that's just one of many things that you've done over the years that's certainly had an opportunity for people to connect with you. And then obviously the people that you talk to on the show as well. I mean, you know, people that many of us idolize. So it's
Well, you know, a lot of the time you don't think that anyone's listening because a podcast that I do from my house,
yeah.
And I think, well, no, who's listening to this? Oh, why am I doing it?
Oh.
And so you know, and plus it costs you money to do it. You don't make any money from it,
yeah.
And you're thinking, why the bloody hell am I doing this? I mean, it's a passion, yes, but is anyone actually listening? And you just think, Christ, someone sent me a message. Has anyone heard it? And then you run into like a random person who goes, hey, man, you haven't posted an episode in a few weeks. What's going on? And you go, oh, I didn't think anyone was listening.
So. I always tell myself to stop looking at the stats because I get really depressed. But then sometimes I need to do it just to make sure that people are tuning in. But
then I bloody did an interview with Gene Simmons,
yeah.
And it went bananas.
Yeah. There you go.
And all of a sudden you're in 98 countries and people are actually now subscribing and listening to your old podcast.
Perfect.
So, yeah.
No, it's only a matter of time. The other thing was, I was really getting excited about this. Your YouTube channel, you had a whole bunch of vlogs that you were doing and just random stuff, random thoughts and things that you're doing. I mean, at one point, you know, you were, and I think you still do a little bit of this, you know, buying and selling cars and getting them fixed up and flipping them. And then also the little road trip series that you did with your mate going over to South Australia and back.
I was
tuning into every single one of them. I was waiting for the next episode to come out and I just thought that's really, really cool. So, I don't know. There's some feedback from me. I'd love to see more stuff like that, even if it's just you in your car getting a rant on about something or something that you've seen out and about or all that kind
of
thing.
Yeah, well, see, that's another thing I enjoy doing. And those two things came about by necessity because when I finished with Triple M, I thought I've got to learn how to do other things. So learning how to podcast and, you know, setting all that up and doing it myself and learning. Like, I had rudimentary audio editing skills, so I sort of bolstered that by doing the podcast. And then the video stuff was just so I could learn a program basically called HitFilm.
Oh, yeah.
It's a free program. And so I just started doing that. And then you learn more as you go because it's fairly intuitive, and I enjoyed it. And I don't know, I guess that was something that was draining because I always thought the people who did daily vlogs did them and then uploaded them that day, but usually they work a couple of days in advance, so you don't have to rush. And I was just crushing myself. Like, I was just working all day trying to put something together, and it got too much. And I've still got another movie that I want to do from my last trip to Bali, which hasn't seen the light of day, and actually one a couple of years ago that didn't see the light of day. So there's still a couple that are kicking around, but it's definitely something. YouTube is something that I like doing and creating something, but it's just got to have the right reason. So I'll definitely get back onto it because it's something I enjoy doing, and I have thought about it a lot, but just trying to figure out what I want to do.
Yeah, definitely. So. And it's one of those things where you could overthink it. And
oh, absolutely, yeah.
And I've certainly done it because I had a couple of attempts of doing it, and I got inspired by some of these big vloggers from the US that and, like, as you mentioned before, look like they're doing it every single day and editing late at night for the next morning's release. And maybe they are because that's their full-time job, they're making so much money off it, but
yeah.
I don't know, I still that's something in my head, and I keep thinking maybe I should do a bit more of it. But I think I need to work out a few ways to get around the mental hurdles of just looking at my own face. I think I need to. I've gotten over the voice thing now. That's taken me. It's taken me a few years, but I've got there. And so next thing's getting in front of my own face and accepting that one. And I think once I get over the hurdle, then I'll be off at the races.
Yeah, that is a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Because you just start picking yourself apart, going, "Oh God," but. But yeah, you do slowly get over that. But yeah, it's something that I think what you said, overthinking it, I just want to find, if you find anything that you're passionate about, you will find an audience. Mm. And I think you've just got to try a whole bunch of different things with YouTube. And I think that's what I was doing with the vlogging stuff. It was, can I do this? Do I like doing this? I like the ranting part of it. Because who doesn't like to have a good rant about something that annoys them?
Yep.
But yeah, I think if it's something that I can, I do have an idea for the next one, but I'm not sure yet. I want to nut it out a little bit more, not overthink it, but just get everything in, all the ducks lined up.
Well, I look forward to it, and even me just talking about it now, because, you know, half the battle with this is just verbalizing it and then realizing, oh, yeah, that's right, it's actually in your mind. Let's translate this into something tangible now and put something out. So now I'm feeling,
well, it's getting over that inherent laziness as well.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm just tiptoeing around, really. All right. Well, I'm keeping on the time. And one last thing before we wrap it up, is there going to be an Amped this year, or he goes heavy cherry?
Well, I asked James, and he was absolutely all for it, because James Young of Cherry Bar, that is, absolutely, because last year was just a huge success, incredible. I was blown away by it. But we've kind of crept through the year, and he's had certain things that have come up, and now we're kind of, you know, you need a few months for this, and it's May, and you kind of go, I want at least 5 months, because you can do it quicker than that, but I think a good lead-in time something of that magnitude, you want it to be spot on. So it has been at the forefront of my mind, and I just spoke to Jason North.
Oh, yeah.
To find out when he's going to be putting on New Dead Festival, because I don't want to clash. So he's given me a time frame roughly for that, and so, you know, I don't want it to do like a week after, that'd be crazy. So you want to try and get a gap. So if it were to happen, it might be November.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where I'm at, but then I might be away in November. So I don't know.
We'll wait and see.
I want to say yes, and I want to get it done, because it was so much fun last time.
Well, I tell you what, last year's lineup was pretty up there. It was and anything sort of associated with Cherry is always sort of like a guaranteed success as well. I mean, best location and venue, and just, I think it just adds to the whole ambience of what it's all about. So, yeah, looking forward to seeing, you know, if that comes to fruition this year. But, I mean, as you said before, you know, I keep thinking it's February. Like, every time I'm talking to someone, I think it's, like, still the second or third month of the year. And
exactly.
We're almost, like, at the halfway point.
Yeah. We're halfway through May already, and you go, oh, Jesus. You know, whereas last year I started organising it in February, mm-hmm. I think it was. And so it was February, March, April, May, June, July. Yeah, so it was a five-month lead-in. So that's what I'm working off, and that was difficult. So, because, again, you don't ask for help. You just try and do it all on your own.
That's it. Carry that weight on your shoulders.
That's it.
No, well, next time, help. Ask for help.
Yeah. I know who to ask now, so it's good.
Yeah, good. All right, man. Yeah. Well, I'm going to let you go. I think we'll do a round two next time and talk a bit more about that birdseed factory job, because I got really excited. Then I thought, no, hang on, I've got other things I need to tick off the list first. But I've written that one down, so we'll come back to that at a later date.
It's really not that exciting.
No, I'm going to hype it up. I'm going to hype it up.
Righto.
All right, mate. Well, take care, and thanks so much for giving me a bit of time to have a chinwag.
No worries at all, man. I appreciate it. Thanks so much. It has been an honour. And just make sure that you look after yourself and your friends.
Will do. You too, mate. Take care.
No, pal. Talk soon. Bye.
Thank you, everyone. I really hope you enjoyed that chat with Higo. If you want to reach out to him and learn a little bit more about what he's all about, and especially I'll have links to the article that we referred to later in our chat as well. Really, really important for a lot of you guys to read, because it's a real interesting insight into a lot of what Higo's been through over the years, and there's some really important messages that I think many of us need to take away in addition to what we just heard in our conversation. So you can go over to andysocial.net. All the links will be there, ways to contact Higo, and just learn more about what he's all about over there. Now I'm going to wrap it up. I'm going to keep this short and sweet, guys. Thank you so much for all the support. As always, you can do all the usual social media love, retweets, likes, love hearts, comments, shares, tags, all that kind of stuff. You can leave reviews everywhere. You can go and buy a t-shirt. You can, I've still got the USB passes for the first 100 episodes. So, you know, if you want the convenience of having my voice travel with you in the pocket of your pants, then you can do that. I don't know where this is going, but it's all over at andysocial.net. Go and check it all out. Thank you so much, guys, and I really appreciate the support. Until next week, guys, take care. Ta-ta. Larry, please.